Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and TheVinnieEastwoodShow.com. Proudly brought to you in collaboration with GorillaMedia.co.nz, coming out on the airwaves in New Zealand on Rush 89 FM in the Tron, Hamilton, the city of the future, the city of Agenda 21. In news today, Egypt revolution through the naked eye. Following the massive anti-government protests, Hosni Mubarak's regime... I love it how they always call it a regime when it's a government that they don't like the Barack H. O'Berry regime, attempted to disconnect Egypt from the rest of the world through a crackdown on internet services. But that hardly deterred the protesters from making themselves heard, despite the attempts at muzzling communication and dissent and the reportedly government-sanctioned shutdown of Egypt's last standing internet service provider to individual users Monday. Egyptians are still managing to get their voices heard and mobilize, both through advanced technical workarounds and older traditional technologies. We're seeing that this is a regime, which is hell-bent on trying to silence the people, not let the word get out. Middle East and North Africa regional editor of Global Voices, Amira Al-Husseini, told IPS in a telephone interview from Bahrain. Now, apparently also, people are being censored even in their own homes, you know, like if they're posting stuff on Facebook or Twitter or things of that nature, there is the possibility that you will get arrested, which is, of course, pretty freaking freaky, and I'd imagine that's pretty easy to track people through Facebook, and Facebook's probably more than willing to oblige any description of tyrannical government to supply said information. That's just speculation on my part, though. I could be wrong. I am very, very freaked out about this. A guy named Sand Monkey has been arrested. The most famous Egyptian English-speaking blogger, the one that has been interviewed 2 days ago by fatalan.wordpress.com, was arrested yesterday. First, the message was spread on Twitter saying his father had tried to call him, but someone else picked up the phone and said, "You are next." And this is also from fatalan.wordpress.com. "I've also tried to call the same person picked up and first said, Efendim, which is used for hello in Turkish, apparently is also used in Egypt. I asked if I can speak to Mahmoud. The person replied, 'Who are you?' I asked the same question. They replied, 'Who are you and where are you from?' I asked again if I could speak with Mahmoud. The person replied, 'Mahmoud, police, you next,' and hung up. I called again the second time and asked if they can tell me if Mahmoud's all right and not injured. The person said, 'Mahmoud, okay.' I asked how long we'll have to stay in the police, and the person shouted, 'Okay, bye, 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 bye,' and hung up. And now Sand Monkey's phone is off." Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the fabulous Egyptian terrorist organization known as Freedom. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, and we'll be right back after the break. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinny Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com, TheVinnyEastwoodShow.com, brought to you in proud collaboration with GuerrillaMedia.co.nz and going out live on the airwaves in many, many places throughout the world. Our very special Kiwi collaborator for today is going to hopefully be joining us for the full show here, the full 2 Mecca hours, is Chris Wingate. He's somewhat of a legend, and if you haven't heard of him after you listen to this interview, you'll never forget him. Chris, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thanks for the great intro.
I know, I'm getting better. I'd love it to, if you could kind of preface for the audience just kind of how you sort of became an activist and more your history personally, because I do like to get make things sort of personal, you know, help to connect, if you will.
Well, I grew up in Rotorua, New Zealand. I left school at 15, started off training as a chef, ended up in Australia when I was 18. Then some years later started a business supplying hotels and restaurants. I was always entrepreneurial. You know, I had market stalls during the weekends, trading all sorts of bits and pieces. You know, by the time I was 25, I was well and truly on my feet. I came back to New Zealand and bought a big property in Rotorua, which is known now as Pauaha Point Lodge. At the time it was called Rose Cottage. I started buying other investments in New Zealand, and also up in North America as well. And my wife and I had been married about 5 years, and we decided to have children. And the best country for having kids was back in New Zealand. So we had a choice of 4 countries to live in. We chose New Zealand. I wanted to come back for a number of reasons. One, I just love the place. I think it's just a stunning, stunning country to be living in. And I wanted to help build my country. So the first business that I set up over there was closed circuit television. And I had agencies for a number of major brands around the world, and the company did very well. And I sold it out to Briley Investments in May 1991. And then in July 91, it was my 30th birthday, and I had friends from around the world. And one in particular was a guy by the name of Irv Sherman, who's a Queen's Counsel from Toronto. And we were sitting in a restaurant over in Tauranga, and I was looking out over Matakana Island, and I started looking around at the development potential in the Tauranga area. I was looking at the expansion of the port and, of course, well aware of all the forestry within the Bay of Plenty, and I started thinking about export and various other things that I could do to, you know, keep myself busy. And so about 2 weeks later, I went over there and made inquiries about Matakana, and I found out that the property was in receivership. It was 10,000 acres covered in Pinus radiata. The land was privately owned since the 1880s. There were no land dispute issues as such. So I found out that I could buy all of Matakana Island for around about 30 plus million. So my interest, of course, was the real estate. It wasn't in the forestry. That simply wasn't a sustainable operation. But through a friend, I went and met with Selwyn Cushing, who was the chairman of Carterholt Harvey. And Carterholt Harvey were the debenture holder who actually put the receivers in place. And I put my argument that I put to him was that the price that the receivers were seeking of 30-plus million was too high, that on a P/E ratio, given the yield from the forestry, that the property was worth perhaps 17, 18 million. So cut a long story short, I got a price of 20 million fixed. I'd negotiated using a forestry consultant with a Japanese company called Kanematsu. We'd negotiated a price off them of around about $15.75 million. And so I needed $4.25 million close the deal, and that's where the story became interesting. I was introduced to a merchant bank called Far Financial in Wellington, And the proposal we put to Far Financial was loan us the $4.25 million. Your security is the 10,000 acres of land, the 1 to 16-year-old forest, because we already have a buyer for the 17 to 34-year-old. We'll sell the 1 to 16-year forest for between $5 and $8 million, pay you back your $4.25, and then we'll go on to develop the 10,000 acres of land. And Far Financial just went straight behind our back. They set up a $100 shelf company and did the deal themselves. They stole the deal from me. So my first reaction coming from Rotorua was to kit up, balaclavas, get a few lads together and go down and beat the snot out of these boys. But, you know, I was a respectable businessman at this stage, so that really wasn't the option. Not that it was a serious one, but it certainly crossed my mind. So I then became involved in litigation. And my involvement with lawyers to this date was relatively limited. But I was introduced to Gary Judd QC in Auckland, who was the chairman of the Auckland Savings Bank. He had quite a bit of experience in this area of law. And in a meeting with him, he said it would cost me $80,000 to $100,000 less than 2 years, slam dunk, I'll win. So I got involved in this horrible litigation process. You know, we had to file a statement of claim, amended statement of claim, you know, various particulars and so on. And all as I could see was the telephone numbers for the legal bills starting to accumulate. But the Maoris at this stage, when I say Maoris, you know, one would think that you're talking about an iwi, but this was kind of a faction off the iwi, but they appeared and they put a road blockade on Matakana Island, claimed that the land was sacred, covered in burial grounds, and they threatened to set fire to the forest, various other acts of intimidation. And they basically said that they wanted the ownership of the Matakana Island land. And so they threatened Far Financial and Far Financial's partners in the transaction to such a point, and also, of course, they were facing my litigation, so they decided to enter into an arrangement whereabouts they would sell out to the Maoris, but in order to do that, they had to lift my caveats, and so an application was made to the court. We pointed out to the judge that these Maoris were there purely on the basis of extortion. He ignored all the evidence that that proved that, and lifted our caveat, said that this would solve Treaty of Waitangi issues, so on and so on. So we appealed that to the Court of Appeal. By the time I had done that, which I was successful in doing, however, it left the Maoris in place and Far Financial and various others with millions in their pocket. You know, my legal bills were well over $500,000. The Maoris were flush with about $5 million in cash because they never had any money to fund themselves into the deal. So what they did was get their hands on the land and then sell off half of it to American property developers. Of course, they never presented them to court as property developers. They showed them as indigenous-loving people from North America who had involvement with Indians up there, and that their only interest was forestry. Forgetting to tell the court that they're in fact one of the largest property developers in North America. At this stage, I had 17 defendants. I hadn't got the bank to court. The Maoris were taking the land on the basis that they would accept the outcome of my case against Far Financial. And so I had to wait until 1997 for a four-week trial against Far Financial. Got them into court, absolutely slaughtered them. They virtually had to carry every one of their witnesses out of the dock. They were clearly guilty. And that's when the real games really started to begin. I got back to Rotorua after spending months endlessly in Auckland in preparation for the litigation. I won't get into detail about some of the other skullduggery, you know, the house break-ins and files go missing and everything else like that. But I got back to Rotorua and I was walking around my property in Kalaha Point. And, you know, I knew that I'd put in an enormous effort. I clearly knew that I'd won. And in walking around the property, I found two marijuana plants in pots hidden around the side of the house. I got rid of them immediately. I figured that there was some skullduggery going on.
Trying to set you up.
Yeah, and so the next morning, four carloads of police turned up with a search warrant for my house. And they took documentation in relation to the litigation from my house. And I got an affidavit from a senior sergeant from the Rotorua Police who explains that at 5 o'clock that afternoon, a lawyer for the Maoris, a guy by the name of Ray Annan, was at the Rotorua Police Station taking photocopies of my private bookwork. And, of course, there was nothing in the bookwork which was really confidential. I'd always, played the part of, my files are open. You can, with the Maoris, I used to have some Maoris say, oh, you're against us. I just say, well, I'm not actually against you. There are details that you're simply not aware of, but, if you have any concerns, get the leadership of Ngāi Te Rangi, including their accountant, to arrange a meeting at the Marae, get them to turn up with their paperwork, I'll turn up with mine, and let's have a meeting and video it. And, of course, they weren't interested, or the leadership certainly weren't interested in that. The people were, because they wanted to know the details of exactly what was going on. I won the 1997 trial against the bank, the four-week trial. The decision was by Justice Paul Tem. Paul died 20 days after the decision was handed down. The defendants then made an application for a retrial. They went before Justice Fisher in the High Court in Auckland. I absolutely slaughtered them on that again. So those two decisions went up to the Court of Appeal, and this was the interesting part. Suddenly the Maori's lawyer, with the governor name of Alan Galbraith, we all know that name, Alan Galbraith jumped up and he said, the important issue here is that perhaps the bank did wrong, that they erred in their discretion. But the important issue is that the sacred lands in the hands of the traditional landowners, in the hands of the Tangata Whenua. And I knew at that stage that, these are the bases that we really, really needed to cover. My lawyer said it was irrelevant. This is about a breach of fiduciary duty of the bank, breach of confidentiality. It's got nothing to do with, land issues, Waitangi issues, Maori pleadings or whatever. But cut a long story short, the judgment came out. One of the judges was on my side, Justice Thomas, Ted Thomas. He wrote a 98-page judgment, and he came out hitting right from the beginning. He basically said that, I cannot believe the position being taken by my fellow judges. The facts and the law are clear. Let me lay it out. The judgment by the majority that went against me, the facts were wrong. They made all sorts of statements in there. They stated that at no stage was Kanimatsu ever prepared to pay $15.75 million, even though the evidence in trial from the general manager of Kanimatsu included a signed detailed contract, signed all the way through to the chairman of Kanimatsu. It was a genuine contract. There was never issue that it wasn't. But this is the sort of thing that I started to realise was going on in amongst our Crown system. Now, over the years as a businessman, I'd obviously dealt with idiots in power. I had my problems with the Rotorua Council regarding my property in Kauaha Point. I won't get into those details, but I think all of us out there have had those problems where you can't understand where the common sense is in amongst the Crown. You've got this official who says, well, this is the way it is, and, they look over their nose at you and that's it. Where is your right to appeal? And with the Court of Appeal decision that came against me, of course, my right of appeal was to the Privy Council in London. So after spending $1 million in the Court of Appeal, by this stage, my total costs were in excess of $4.5 million. It was off to London. And I got a chap over there by the name of Sir Nicholas Underhill, who's the Attorney General for Prince Charles. I had Professor Peter Birks from Oxford University. My other consultants have included Professor Paul Thin from Australia National University. Of course, I had my mate Irv Sherman from Toronto, you know, giving me advice on various things. In other words, I put together a formidable team of legal experts from around the world, and I well and truly understood fiduciary obligations. I understood the law, the history of it, and exactly where it stemmed from. So off to the Privy Council we went. I was warned by Gary Judd QC, don't go there with Justice John Henry on the panel because you would lose. And I didn't quite understand that, but 24 hours before we were about to have our hearing, and the Privy Council, by the way, is in Downing Street right next to the Prime Minister's office. So you've got to go through those big gates where all the security is, and you know, you sort of feel all important that you're going somewhere very special. We went. Justice Henry was on the panel, but 24 hours prior, Lord Cook, one of our famous judges from New Zealand, had withdrawn because he had a conflict of interest, and the conflict of interest was that he shared his holidays with one of the directors of Far Financial and down at Lake Taupo. So, you know, I knew that Far Financial I knew that they had connections. I'd been warned by a number of people that they had connections. But this was the first sort of, you know, real heads up of, you know, these guys, you know, really do have connections in high places. Anyway, the Galbraith jumped up. He did the same thing. He said maybe the bank did wrong, but the important issue is that the sacred land's in the hands of the traditional landowners, blah, blah, blah. Henry wrote the judgment against me and basically said that the Court of Appeal were right in the facts, they were correct, and that there's no need to get into detail. But the judgment out of the Court of Appeal and the Privy Council was completely, you know, fraudulent. It's quite simple to show the evidence that was before the court, and I'm talking irrefutable evidence, not hearsay, I'm talking about actual documents. So what they say is just fictional, it's made up, and it's invented for a purpose. When I got back to New Zealand, I bumped into a top New Zealand silk who patted me down for my cell phone, checked me for a wire, asked me for a pledge that I wouldn't. Are we coming back after this, eh?
Yes, we will. And this is where it gets really, really interesting, ladies and gentlemen. Our very special guest is Christopher Wingate, our Kiwi collaborator for today, joining us live from Perth in Australia. We'll be right back after these messages.
Look at me, driving and I won't stop. And it feels so good to be alive and on top. My reach is global, my tower secure, my cause is noble, my power is pure. I can hand out a million vaccinations, or let them all die in exasperation. Have them all healed from the lacerations, have them all killed by assassination. I can make anybody go to prison, just because I don't like them. And I can do anything with no permission. I have it all under my command, because I can guide a missile by satellite, by satellite, by satellite. And I can hit a target through a telescope, through a telescope, through a telescope. And I can end the planet in a holocaust.
And we're back. We are back live on the Vinnie Eastwood Show, where we offer the final solution, in the Hitlerian sense of the word, to mainstream media. And I was wondering the other day whether or not they should all be herded onto cattle cars and exterminated. But, you know, I guess that's just not our way in the truth movement, is it? You know, peaceful, violent, peaceful or violent, you know, I'd probably pick the peaceful solutions, which is basically just calling them all scum and saying that nobody should listen to them and instead listen to us. Welcome back to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and the VinnieEastwoodShow.com, brought to you in proud collaboration with GuerrillaMedia.co.nz. Our extremely special guest, who I'm very proud to bring you, is Christopher Wingate, coming to us live from Perth in Australia. Welcome back, Chris.
Yeah, good day. So,
all right. Now, before we went on to break, some guy was calling you up for a meeting and he was patting you down for wires. Who was this person?
Well, I've given my undertaking that I won't identify him. That's something that I've been discussing with the producer of our film. You know, if you give your word, you give your word. He's a well-known, very well-known barrister. But what was interesting after he patted me down was the information that he then told me. He said that, Justice John Henry and Alan Galbraith, you see, were business partners. They're friends. They've known each other for a lifetime. He told me basically the network of judges and top silks at the top of basically deals are done behind the scenes. You know, they contact each other on a regular basis, talk about cases, but one of the better things that he told me was that the relationship between Chief Justice's son, Sir Thomas Eichelbaum in New Zealand, his son John Eichelbaum, was a barrister who was actually working for Far Financial, but he was also a business partner of Far Financial. His relationship went back many years with them. And, of course, John Eichelbaum's partner in Chambers at the time was Sir Geoffrey Palmer, the former Prime Minister, Minister of Justice, before that Professor of Law at Victoria University. He was there with Sir Ivor Richardson and Sir Kenneth Keith, who were both on the Court of Appeal panel that went against me. He told me he basically filled in, you know, quite a bit of the landscape so that I got an understanding of the nature of the play. If I can just backtrack slightly to talk about the Maoris, in just before the Privy Council, which was at the end of 1999, in July of 99, there was a body of a chap by the name of Sonny Tapia found on Matakana Island. His body was found in the back seat of his car, and the car was burned out. And I knew Sonny Tapia. He had actually put in a Waitangi claim for the wider sort of Tauranga Matakana area. And, of course, Waitangi claims don't affect private land ownership. It's a claim against the Crown, so it didn't affect me. And but I certainly saw the defendants use it as much as they could in the litigation. The Maori defendants had actually stated that they would give up the Waitangi claims if they got ownership of the land, and I thought that was interesting and wondered what sort of relationship they had with Sonny Tapia. Sonny was doing it on behalf of the people, yet the Maori leadership of United only had a commercial company called Tiko Tukutuku, also known as TKC, and it was TKC who had actually taken the ownership of Matakana Island. Now, after I lost in the Court of Appeal, which was in 1998, Sonny Tapia phoned me, and he said, you know, what's going on? You know, we've won, but what exactly have we won? Because leadership won't tell us any information and say it's all secret. So I asked him a few questions. He clearly knew nothing about Blakely Pacific, the purchase by Blakely of the freehold of the land. He didn't know anything about a whole range of things. So I sent him probably about a kilo of documentation, and he was absolutely furious, and he confronted the leadership of United Only on the Marae, and apparently it was one hell of a fight. Anybody listening in from Matakana Island who were there, you would well and truly know it. Sonny had the information, and he cornered them, and that began a very, very uncomfortable time for Sonny. And so his body was found before the Privy Council. Before the Privy Council hearing, it was found over in Matakana Island, and just a couple of years ago, I got a copy of the police report, and what the police said was that he drove into the forest early in the morning, around about 8 o'clock, he entered the forest in his vehicle, that he climbed out of his car, took a can of petrol out of the boot, at the right rear wheel, took his only top off, his knitted top, took his boots off, set them on fire with petrol in the right rear wheel. But what was interesting was it also included the lighter that was found in amongst the remnants. But while that fire was going, according to the police, he then poured petrol under the entire boot, up the left-hand side of the vehicle, the entire interior of the car, puts the can of petrol back in the boot, closes the boot, gets in the back seat, closes the door, and sets himself on fire. So the police, within 3 days, or one particular policeman, he entered into the computer database and the driver's licenses to cancel Sonny's driver's license. He puts down it's cancelled because of death, and cause of death, suicide. Now, what I found fascinating was the fact that 4 separate witnesses, Sonny's girlfriend and various other people who were on committees with him, stated that a chap by the name of Don Shaw, who was a 12.5% shareholder, well, in fact, on paper, he was a 25% shareholder at the time that Tico took it to him, but he was actually hiding the shares of the trust accountant, Graham Ingham, Ingham Morat and Associates of Tauranga. The police statements say that Don Shaw had threatened to kill Sonny Tafia, that Sonny had somehow got hold of documentation that he wasn't supposed to have, supposedly. But what was interesting was the police never interviewed Don Shaw. But Don Shaw is ex-Naval Special Forces. He was also the head of customs and the guy who appears to be untouchable. So the police didn't make any inquiry of that. Sonny's family were crying out that it was foul play, but they didn't take any notice of that. So clearly Sonny Tafia was murdered, the police shut that file down relatively quickly. The coroner, who was a well-known town lawyer, he's refused to answer any questions in relation to it. When I filed a complaint with the Bay of Plenty Police with regards to the poor quality of the investigation and the fact that they hadn't, the fact that material that was actually contained within the file was incorrect, they hadn't carried out any form of an investigation of any sense at all. A friend of mine made contact with me and said that my file is a hot potato with the Rotorua Police Station, police headquarters, and that nobody wants to touch it. But I started complaining with various members of Parliament regarding the Privy Council decision after I'd lost the Privy Council. And a chap by the name of Russell Fairbrother, who was a member of Parliament, he came up to Rotorua. He said he was a former barrister. He knows the clicking bunch of judges that I'm up against, and basically repeated the same comment that I'd heard from the university luncheon I had with that senior silk some years earlier when I got patted down. And he said that Parliament's got more power than the judiciary, he's going to put it to the Justice Select Committee, which he was a member of, the facts and the law are clear, that I would win. And he said that he'd be back in a month with the documentation for me to sign for the matter to proceed in Parliament. And I had a meeting in Auckland, I had a luncheon meeting with two lawyers, Rodney Newman and Bob Stevens. And this was about 2 weeks after the Fairbrother meeting in Rotorua. And I said to them exactly what Fairbrother had said, that I was excited that the matter was going to go to Parliament. And when I passed the comment about, Russell saying that Parliament's got more power, he knows the clicky bunch of judges, et cetera, et cetera, for the first time, Bob Stevens for a number of years, he became incredibly angry. And he said that, I can't swear on him, but he said that Fairbrother should, shut his mouth, that he should know better than that they'll kill his kids. Now, that was an incredibly strong statement coming from a lawyer who in fact works for the government. And I thought, I conveyed that information to a number of people via email because I wanted it to be on record. But 2 weeks later, on the date that their brother was to come to my home, he was late. He was about 8 hours late for the meeting, and my wife immediately noticed that he was incredibly nervous. He was sweating, even though it was during winter. He was incredibly uncomfortable, and he said that the terms of reference cannot include any allegations of wrongdoing by lawyers or judges. In other words, the only inquiry that I could get in Parliament was a cover-up. But he never had the documentation for me to go ahead with the select inquiry. In fact, he was just a mumbling idiot. There was really no sense coming out of him at all. And off he wandered, and he then went silent. And a few months after that, there was an explosion in his daughter's house in Hastings, and his two grandkids were killed. And the police inquiry into that said that they were unable to determine the cause of the explosion. Now, they can take a jet out of the bottom of the ocean and produce a fuse and say where it was manufactured, and that was the cause of the explosion. They weren't able to pinpoint the cause of the explosion in their brother's daughter's house in Hastings.
Yeah, right. Sounds like a nice little cover-up there.
Well, you know, we've seen a few of those things go on in New Zealand over the years. And, you know, when people have, you know, the authorities basically say that, you know, this is the way it is, and everybody seems to accept it. But, you know, certainly by this stage, I've really got my hiccups up. I could get into a lot of detail, but I won't at this stage because that's all in our documentary. But you know, I started really pushing for the politicians, namely for the Attorney General, the Prime Minister, and, of course, the Chief Justice, to deal with the fact that, you know, what's gone on here with the Matakana litigation is basically a crime scene. We need a proper inquiry. We need offshore investigators to be looking at this because I simply don't trust, what's going on in New Zealand. But, you know, what you find is that, if anybody out there has ever had a matter which they've wanted a member of parliament to deal with, you simply get back a letter which states...
That states, we would listen to you, except we can't because we're just that retarded. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show on the VinnieEastwoodShow.com and American Freedom Radio Network. Our very special Kiwi collaborator for today is Chris Wingate, joining us for the duration of the whole show today. And we'll be right back after the break.
We got to change the way we see the problem if we're gonna fix this place. My living soul don't care about the color of your face. Unite and roll, respect our right to live here on the land. It's Tino Ranga, Tino Tonga, we don't own the banks. The parliament does so where do you rather stand? They paying their bills off your back with hefty tax demands. Misleading our youth with alcohol, TV, contrabands. So kids act up and disturb our community. Uninformed public then consents to our planned absurdity. What? Replace our human rights with commercial slavery. They print a hundred buck and loan it to you. They charge interest on the loan but don't...
Welcome back. Ladies and gentlemen, to the show, broadcasting live from the fabulous Fluoride Head Fortress, New Zealand, where taxation, robbery, and corruption is part of the game. Our very special guest joining us from Perth, Australia, our wonderful Kiwi collaborator for today, is Chris Wingate. Welcome back, Chris.
Welcome.
Now, if you have a... where we left off, you're about to get into the fact that when you ask a politician a question, basically they just dodge them, and you really can't hold them to account because they just walk away. You can't call the cops on them and say, oh, these guys didn't answer my questions, and it's really important that they do. But you have a solution for this that hasn't been tried before. It's called constitutional jury system. If you would, please divulge what it is. Now, we've got just a short segment here, so you might have to be brief.
Okay, well, the relationship between the public and the politician is a fiduciary relationship. My litigation against the bank was about breach of fiduciary duty. Fiduciary comes from the Latin word fiduci, which means trust. And in our common law, we've got a history of cases that people who are in a power-dependent relationship owe a duty of care. Now, the public conferred power to politicians. Government is a trust structure owned by the people collectively in the country, and that we confer power to the politician with their election. And so the relationship is clearly fiduciary, but the interesting thing about, you know, New Zealand probably has around about 10 or 12,000 fiduciaries in total, you know, engineers and lawyers and doctors and so on, politicians, judges. But judges and politicians have crown and judicial immunity, which means that you can't hold them to account for breach of fiduciary duty. It's in the Judicial Amendment Act and also in the Crown Proceedings Act. It's just two sentences in there that basically say that you're stuffed if you want to take a claim against them. Now, I thought that was completely wrong. I mean, talking to everybody in society, you know, everybody's like, well, they should be accountable. Now, if you talk to the people in amongst the system and you ask them, where is your accountability, they say, oh, you know, we've got checks and balances and this and that and the other. And if you've got a, you know, if you've got a problem, you don't like the system, then you can simply vote. And, of course, you know, what's the use of a vote if you've got a complaint about serious corruption? It just means simply nothing. In other words, we don't have any ability to be able to hold them to account. So after all my complaints to the politicians and having them ignore me, I was offered a seat by Judith Kirk, the head of the National Party for Rotorua, and I said, you know, I'm not interested. And a few days later, I got a phone call from Sir Peter Tapsell, who said, Chris, you're crazy. You're not going to be able to make a change from the outside. You can only make a change from the inside. And I said, look, I've got no interest in going down and playing the political game. I'll make my changes from the outside. So I devised a plan to do a documentary to educate the public that the problem with the system is that we have crown and judicial immunity. That's the weakness. And in fact, that's their Achilles heel. That's how they are able to fob everybody off and basically be lazy, stupid. You know, that's how you basically get idiots in power. So even though the duty of the fiduciary is to be selfless and, of course, bring expertise to the table. And unfortunately, you know, too many politicians don't do that. They simply don't need to, you know, really have their eye on the ball. They can just be lazy and do what they want. Some didn't go through. So what I saw as the weakness was that all the political parties in New Zealand actually have very thin membership. Not only do they have thin membership, but even less, they have very few people who actually attend the political party meetings. And so my plan is to educate the public about the dangers of crown and judicial immunity. If you want them to be accountable, what we need to do is to attend those meetings. We need to join the political parties, or if we're already a member, go to those meetings, and then keep putting our hands up saying that we want the political party policy to change to remove crown and judicial immunity so that we can have true accountability in the system. You only need somebody else to second that adamant, and you only need to be able to then carry the vote. And that fast becomes political party policy. And if they have any incumbent politicians down there in Wellington, then they're fixed with that as the party policy. And so therefore, it then filters down to legislation. Now, once we've removed crown and judicial immunity, we then get our politicians, who would then be working for us, bring in what's called a constitutional jury. So if you've got a complaint like mine, I would be able to go to the courthouse in Rotorua. I'd say that I've got a judgment that's fictional. And I do that on an ex parte basis. I don't need to, in case I'm a nutcase, I don't need to tie up the Chief Justice, Attorney General, I go along with Sparta and I say, well, this is what I've done. This is clearly bad public policy. And I would get an order from them against the Minister of Justice, Attorney General, and the judges for what's called interrogatories, where that's, I can put questions to them. They have to probably answer them. If they don't answer them, I can go back to another jury and I can apply for a suspension of their pay and power. And that's direct people power. That means that those who we trust to run our systems of state will be held accountable, and they have to be held accountable. You know, there's too much skullduggery going on around the world, and this isn't just a New Zealand problem, this is an international problem. You know, our politicians.
Well, it's true that there's not a country on earth that has to deal with politicians in a reasonable manner. You know, it's like they're all part of the same freaking gang. They're all playing PR and mind games on us, and they're never really getting to the point, which is that our countries are completely effed up. They're diseased and they're crumbling under our very noses and under our very feet and threaten to cast us out into a ridiculously enormous chasm. And it's not cool, man. And it's just about time we got rid of these scum and got rid of their immunity. You're listening to The Vinnie Eastwood Show on thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. Our special guest is Chris Wingate, coming out live from Perth, Australia. And we'll be right back after the break. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and TheVinnieEastwoodShow.com, brought to you in proud collaboration with GorillaMedia.co.nz, New Zealand's unconventional news, broadcasting live from the future in the sunny slave capital of Auckland, New Zealand. Our very special guest joining us live from Perth, Australia, is the legendary Chris Wingate. Chris, welcome back to the program.
Hey.
Okay, now, you were fading out just a little bit on the segment there before. Could you redefine for us, I mean, what is Crown and judicial immunity? I mean, does that mean that they're immune from criminal prosecution, like if a politician, like, shoots a protester or something like that with a six-shooter, can he not be arrested or charged because he's got judicial immunity or whatever? I mean, what's the deal here?
Well, no. You know, if they commit a crime, then they, you know, they're held accountable. But, you know, if a politician were to commit a crime and they were to have an inquiry, which we would term, you know, if we knew the facts and we knew that they had a cover-up, then you couldn't hold them to account for the cover-up. You know, Crown and judicial immunity comes from the old king's rule of the king can do no wrong in the service of the people. In some countries, it's called crown immunity. In other countries, it's called sovereign immunity. But they both have the same effect. It basically means that, you know, we, the public, can't hold them to account when they fail. And, you know, my proposal for modernising democracy is basically that, you know, we remove the crown and judicial immunity. We have access to a local jury. The jury is looked after by a JP, not a judge, because the judge is, unfortunately, just part of the inner circle. And they can, you know, cut you off, but you have an unfettered access to a jury. You state your case, and if you get an order from the, you know, from the jury, you can get compulsory questions answered by the politicians, and that if they fail to answer those questions, then you can go back and get a suspension order. But if they do answer the questions, and clearly you can prove that there's been a cover-up or a failure, a breach of fiduciary duty, a failure of duty of care, then you can go back to a jury as well. And you can say that, you know, I've proven my case. You can see in their answers that they just don't care about the failure. And again, you can apply for a suspension of their wages, suspension of power order. And of course, that is the only way in which we can solve the political problem of mismanagement. You know, people think that, you know, well, if I vote in Labor, well, you know, they're going to solve all the problems. Well, we've been down that track for many, many years. You know, we all think that the new politician is going to solve all of the ills of the world, and that this person will be our savior. Course, you know, we get let down time and time again. And of course, we get let down because it's the system that's actually faulty. They have a system whereabouts they have authority and power without any accountability. Now, if you had a sports team that you had to fund every year and, you know, week after week, the sports team didn't turn up for training, they lose every single game, but you still have to fund them, you're going to get annoyed, aren't you?
Well, yeah, and you'd probably fire them because they're not doing their jobs. Whereas for some reason, people don't think that you should be able to do that to politicians, because when they don't do their jobs, people frickin' die. You're listening to The Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and TheVinnieEastwoodShow.com, and we'll be right back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Listening to the soothing sounds of the New Zealand National Anthem, the Godfather soundtrack, on American Freedom Radio and the TheVinnieEastwoodShow.com, broadcasting live from the future on Rush 89 FM in Hamilton. And we were talking over the break about political apathy. And yeah, I'll put my hands up. I'm pretty politically apathetic, because every time that I've ever tried to approach a politician to get an answer of some description of question that's of importance to my nation, I get ignored. Every time that I send a document or a question into their email addresses or mail it to them or anything, I get ignored. And I would imagine that I'm not the only person who gets ignored often enough to then think, there's nothing I can do, so I'm not going to bother getting involved in politics. And this is the real problem that we have in our nations, isn't it, ladies and gentlemen? That we don't care anymore how politics works, because we've become used to the fact that politics doesn't work, and if we did want to try and make it work, it wouldn't work. And that's where political apathy really, really hits home. Now, the solution to this is direct democracy. Now, it's different from democracy where you just tick a box once every couple of years and go to the politicians. Hey, I want that scumbag instead of this scumbag, because this scumbag over here has done really naughty stuff to us, and so I want to vote for that scumbag over there because he represents my views better than that scumbag. All right, thank you very much. That's that's democracy. Direct democracy is every single day you tell your politicians what you want, and you tell them what to do, okay? That's when the politicians have to listen to you, because they have no frickin' choice in the matter, okay? And that's what we really, really need, because it is a vanguard against political apathy, which is, in my opinion, the only reason why we have systems that don't work in the first effing place. Because people don't care enough to take responsibility for them, because they can't. Our very special guest joining us from Perth, Australia, is Chris Wingate, our Kiwi collaborator for today. Chris, welcome back.
Welcome. Now, you know, when Judith Kirk made contact with me for taking the seat for Rotorua, I turned it down. I turned it down because, you know, in my corporate background, when you sit at the board table, and if you've got a fool who's sitting around the board table, you can fire him. You see, in politics, you can't instruct your smart teams. You have to suffer fools, and I don't suffer fools very well. They're not pleasant. But, you know, some people are just plain stupid, and there's no way in the world that they can see common sense. So the problem with the political system that we've got at the moment is that it's a system that is manipulated basically for an effect. In New Zealand, for example, we've noticed that more and more GDP every single year ends up in the hands of the legal industry. You know, the lawyers, they control the system. They have basically for 30 years. They talk about separation of power, and that's something I would encourage people to look into. It's an old idea that, you know, we've got separate hands on the power of the executive, you know, basically, you know, the executive, the politicians, parliament, and then the other hand on the power is the judiciary, and they say that there are walls between them.
Can you speak up a bit there, Chris?
Yeah, you ask them why they've got walls between the separate areas of government, and they say we've got separation of power so that we can have checks and balances. And immediately then, you know, I ask them, well, you know, I've got a problem with the judiciary, whereabouts I've got corruption going on. You know, whereabouts are the checks and balances? And they say, well, you know, we, in fact, Christopher Finlayson, the current Attorney General, he said, well, I can't interfere with the judiciary because of separation of power. Now, separation of power is not even a law. It's not a rule. It's just an idea. But this is the sort of crap that you put up with. But Christopher Finlayson has a direct conflict of interest. I mean, he was a partner of Bell Gully, and ITT Ryanair are one of their biggest clients, and they were one of the defendants. They purchased the 17 to 34-year-old forest of Far Financial, and they made about, you know, between $15 and $20 million profit out of it. You know, this is the sort of nonsense that we put up with. I mean, even though Finlayson has a conflict of interest, you know, where is my power to hold him to account, to get him to step aside because of that conflict? And even if he did make a decision, if he did intervene and made a decision and the decision was, you know, completely wrong, it was contrary to what the facts were that I presented to him. What could I do about it? I can't do anything. And you can't do anything about, you know, you practically can't do anything with mainstream media, anything to do with the law. They refer it to their legal section, and their legal section are lawyers. And, you know, they'll shut it down. Any complaints against the judiciary in New Zealand just isn't allowed. And so every single month we've got more and more legislation being passed through our parliamentary system that require you to go and see a lawyer. And so the lawyer's income just goes up and up and up and up. I mean, how many of us know of, you know, couples that sadly divorce, there's custody issues for a child, and that the father, you know, finally gets to court after spending a huge amount of money to be able to get access for his child, an order is made, and then the ex-wife breaches the order. He can't go to the police. He has to go back to his lawyer, who has to go back to court, and then another order is made. She's told off. But no penalty was imposed, and it just goes on and on and on and on and on for years. And, you know, plenty of husbands out there have spent, you know, many, many, you know, tens of thousands, some in some cases hundreds of thousands of dollars. The legal system is just a rort. It's a money-making monopoly for lawyers just to cash in. And unfortunately, the way that they're making their rort is they're strapping us down with red tape. And that red tape is destroying our engines of the economy. You know, microeconomic structures have just been destroyed all over the country, and New Zealand's heading down the gurgler. Now, I've been warning about this for years and years and years, and they don't bloody listen. There's no way that the politicians or the people who have got the power to be able to make the decisions, there's no way in the world that they even have the most basic skills to understand the dangers of what's facing New Zealand at the moment. What they do is that they make handout to the public. You know, they give them like a lolly scramble, in exchange for a vote. But of course, the lollies, we pay for them. And this is why New Zealand is going downhill. You know, I had some years in the equities market. A lot of my mates take care of some of the largest funds in the world. And to them, New Zealand is just a complete bloody joke. You know, there's no way in the world that they would be interested in putting any serious money down there. The red tape, the bureaucracy, the endless Maori claims, it's just harming New Zealand's image. And we've really got to do something about it if we want to save our country. We're now the third most indebted nation in the OECD. You know, we're in a very, very dangerous position. My forecast is that we're going to have inflation. It's going to go through the roof. Interest rates are going to go through the roof. A lot of people think that their wealth is in the value of their real estate. I would encourage them to get on the internet and look at a beautiful city like Indianapolis in the United States and have a look where you can buy a house there for $20,000, rent it out for $700 a month. This is a four-bedroom, quarter-acre section, wooden house, which is quite beautiful. That same house in Auckland's $500,000. You know, the bankers have just borrowed money cheaply from overseas, pumped it into New Zealand, and it's like a big gambling market. So, you know, unless we get a handle on it.
Well, my concern is just the general disparity between the amount of power individuals have over their own lives and the amount of power government has. And it's just any issue you want to look at, we see legal professionals or health professionals or any from XYZ government or corporate institution over the levers of power. So right now in the United States, the issue of bisphenol A on receipts has come up. And it's been found that over 93% of Americans are contaminated with this BPA substance that's on that's used in the ink on thermal sort of printing systems that most retailers use for receipts. And this BPA, bisphenol A, estrogen-mimicking substance, is prevalent hundreds of times greater amounts than it is in canned foods or bottles or anything else on receipts alone. So, you know, rather than the debate being public, rather than it being an election issue, rather than it being in the public domain whatsoever, it's amongst legal professionals and health practitioners.
I completely agree with you, Will, is that the power to run your own life and that kind of thing gradually being taken away from you. I mean, when you vote, you're basically sending a message to government, and the message you're sending by voting is, I don't want any power, I don't want any rights, please make me a slave incrementally.
And the only way we end up with these idiots in power is via social Darwinism, is by the public themselves being idiotic. And so because most of the public can't actually handle how severe some of our realities are, because they're soft, dumbed-down fools, to put it mildly, therefore we end up with these soft, weakling, doe-eyed freaks in power. And I see them all the time. Like this Gareth Hughes scumbag we had on air here, the youngest parliamentarian in New Zealand, in the Green Party, complete idiot, told me he was comfortable with climate change. I said, look, it's not a matter of you being comfortable. It's a matter of the taxpayers being comfortable. You're a public servant. But these scum, just every single time, no matter which way you turn, they are just arrogantly just trying to reassure the public and just get everyone just to stand down and keep being a slave and keep paying taxes.
Yeah, and that's the interesting thing about these politicians, is that they never explain situations. They only reiterate the propaganda that they've been told to spread, you know?
Yeah.
Where is the deeper understanding of issues? Yeah.
I'll tell you, it's not time for debate. We can't have those debates because then some people won't understand, so we have to dumb it down.
Yeah. Well, if that... Every time is the time for debate. The only reason why anybody can, you know, follow something that's BS is because they haven't had a debate on it. All right?
Yeah.
If you can't debate things, you won't understand them, period.
If I had the power to call for an inquiry, one of the inquiries I would have immediately, and I'd give it unlimited bridal power with terms of reference, and that is to look into the commodities market around the world, to have a look at just how much money the Wall Street boys and other commodity traders are making out of food and oil. You know, they bid the market up They buy all the options of supply until they've cornered the market, and then they sell it actually into the demand at an inflated price. And it's making them, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars, you know, every month. But, you know, the guy in the village in India is having to pay more for his rice and more for his, you know, kerosene, you know, to keep his lamp going. You can see in New Zealand, you know, with just the inflation that's gone on over there, people can't afford the basic bills. New Zealand's offloaded its state-owned assets, which is another subject which, you know, don't get me started on, but let me start myself. You know, Labor and National Party received millions of dollars in donations from Faye Richwhite. And then all of a sudden, Faye Richwhite got, you know, control of telecom, disposal of the sale of telecom. That made them $1 billion. You know, New Zealand Railways, a bank in New Zealand, various forestry assets and so on. This is just plain wrong. I mean, this is seriously wrong. And, you know, the banking boys out there, as much as they provide service, they've just gone overboard. They've just gone completely overboard, and they have, they're totally disconnected from the net reality danger of what their games play to the ordinary man in the street.
Well, and of course, they're totally. You know, sorry, Christopher.
You know, no, that's all right. Go on.
I was just going to say, I mean, what they say to the average man in the street, what these politicians say, is just completely out of line with the facts that are available. So right now here in New Zealand, we can see that our net foreign liabilities are over 85% of our GDP. At the same time, though, our Bill English, who's to deliver our 2011 budget on May 19, has just said that the government... that the theme of the 2011 budget will be about, quote, building savings and investment, because as a country we need to save more, spend a bit less, and reduce our heavy reliance on foreign debt, says the man responsible, partially responsible, for our $300 million a week borrowing habit. Like
yeah.
A drunken
okay,
gambler
well,
at the table.
Yeah, okay. Now, as far as savings go, after I lost in the Privy Council, Far Financial then went and set up Lombard Finance with Michael Reeves down in Wellington. And on the board of directors went Sir Douglas Graham and Bill Jeffries, Attorney General, Minister of Justices, Minister for the Serious Fraud Office. You know, I was often wondering why the hell I couldn't, you know, ever make any traction regarding any of my complaints. Now, I'm not saying that these people individually intervened in protecting Far Financial, but this is the type of crap that goes on in New Zealand. Now, I knew what Michael Reeves and Ian Smith were all about, so I made a number of, you know, warnings to the Attorney General, Margaret Wilson, about Lombard. I also warned her about Blue Chip. She ignored it, just totally ignored my warnings. And, you know, they have the control to set the rules, the regulatory rules, with regards to whoever takes the deposit off members of the public. They just ignored that completely, and so you've got 232,000 New Zealanders who deposited their money with, you know, these finance companies, lose $8.5 billion. And, you know, now you've got the government coming out saying that, but people have to save. Well, they bloody well did save. They saved $8.5 billion in cash. You know, this is mums and dads, grandparents, young couples. You know, this was their savings that has just been decimated because of the inaction and the incompetence of the people that we trust to run our systems of state. And let me reiterate that government is a trust structure. We, the people, own the structure. In every country, we, the people, own the structure. And we confer the power to the politicians to administer the management of that structure. And these people are failing us. And the area of law that people have to get to understand is fiduciary law, fiduciary obligation, power-dependent relationships, whereabouts you confer the power to an expert and they have to bring to the table expertise, and they don't.
Well, yeah, and that's the interesting thing about government, isn't it? You expect that they're experts, but when in reality, they're just upstarts. You're listening to The Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and TheVinnieEastwoodShow.com. Proudly brought to you by GorillaMedia.co.nz. Our very special guest is Chris Wingate, live from Perth, our Kiwi collaborator, and we'll be right back after the break. Everywhere I go, the faces of politicians I see, and every single time I talk to them, they don't look back at me. You're listening to The Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and TheVinnieEastwoodShow.com, brought to you in proud collaboration with GorillaMedia.co.nz, New Zealand's unconventional news. Our very special guest, Chris Wingate, is joining us live from Perth. Welcome back, Chris.
Welcome. I'm pleased that we've got these breaks in between.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you keep going and going and going, you kind of get exhausted a heck of a lot quicker, which is why, you know, I'd really love to do a three-hour show or something like that, because the breaks make it just that much easier to keep going. But when we talk about the government, as we were talking before about apathy and accountability and all these different range of factors, the other factor that is often ignored, and well, in fact, is completely ignored from our politicians and their campaign speeches, is just how much inordinate influence there is on them from international influences, and more to the point, national intelligence agencies. You know, when you become prime minister or president or anything like that, you then get briefed as to the reality of what's really going on in your country. And as you said, Barack H. O'Barry, after he was briefed by the CIA, after he walked out of that meeting, it looked like he aged 20 years.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I know quite a few people involved in the security industry, and with my close-circuit television company I used to own, I used to attend a number of security conferences, and I remember one time I was in New York with a chap by the name of David Albuquerque, and David's had an involvement with Mossad for you know, right from its beginning. He owns a giant conglomerate called Elbex. And I was with David in New York, and I had to go down to Washington, D.C. This was during the time of the preparation of Desert Storm. And, you know, I was just sort of a naive individual who thought that, you know, our systems of state are perfect, that Saddam Hussein was the bad guy who had invaded Kuwait, and that the Americans are going to go in there and they're going to kick his ass and restore democracy to Iraq. But you know, what I came to understand was that the Americans actually organized the invasion of Kuwait, and that they did it purely for money. They needed to offload the Cold War surplus weaponry, upgrade to new stuff, and the government in exile paid the Americans substantial amounts of money in order to, you know, to get Saddam Hussein out. And so when I got back to New Zealand, I was telling people that the Americans have no interest in going after Saddam Hussein, that, you know, there's going to be a little bit of an appearance of a take back of the country, but they're going to leave him in power because they need the instability to stay in the region, so that the you know, the neighbouring countries would be purchasing a whole pile of weapons, which is exactly what happened. And it's these sort of rotten games that go on. And some of these guys that, you know, are well-connected that I know, I say to them, look, we can't play these sort of games because you're going to piss the wrong sort of person off. You're going to get some factional group who's going to get their hands on weapons of mass destruction, and they're going to plant them in amongst innocent people, and they're going to kill a lot of people. But if you take a look at the reason as to why they actually, turn into one of these international terrorists, it's because they're getting hard done by, that they're getting beaten up, and nobody in the system actually cares. I mean, after what I've gone through with the Matakana litigation, I can understand a person becoming a terrorist. I was so pissed off with the judicial system. I was going to exact retribution on those guys, in a very dangerous way. And I can openly say that. I've said it before, and I'll say it again. That's how wild I was. I could not believe that the people that we trust to run our systems of state could be so rotten. And, this is the sad reality that we've got.
That's the same thing that the public say all the time. I just can't believe that how corrupt that they could be that corrupt. As if it means that they're not.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, we have these terms like democracy. We have separation of powers. We have separation of church and state. We have all these nice little secular atheist things that people like to think are boundaries to corruption. But then in their sterile view of how the system works, they don't understand, they being 80 to 90% of the population, don't understand that there are networks, behind these legitimate structures. There are old networks, and I always harp on about this, because there's a real government behind the official government. And the real government is largely comprised of intelligence networks. But if anyone knows about how intelligence networks began, intelligence networks, including MI5, are rooted in secret societies in every single way, in the terms of how they're structured, in terms of their symbology, in terms of a lot of their practices, and in terms of their membership. You mentioned Bill Jeffries. Yeah. He's a high level Freemason, is he not?
Yeah. With the intelligence agencies, you've got a lot of good people who do work in there, but they don't really understand what a lot of their work is about. It's about collection of information. Anybody in society who puts their head above the water and makes a noise, they open a file on them. Open a file is exactly what? It's hiding cameras and microphones and basically finding out what a person's made of and what their weaknesses are. And all humans have weaknesses. They go and find those weaknesses. And, years later, that person who puts their head above, the water, is perhaps now a member of parliament. And unfortunately, there will come the day when he will be approached by somebody and told that, there's a certain group that, want to nail you because, you gave it to the babysitter once. But we've got something against them but you're going to have to vote along these particular lines. That's the sort of dirt that goes on in the system. I'm not saying that it happens every day all the time. That's the sort of thing that does, in fact, go on.
That's overtly visible when people actually it's less visible in the system as a whole, but when you put a magnifying glass on groups like Skull and Bones, John Kerry and George Bush, and George Bush's father and grandfather, when you put a magnifying glass on those groups, you see that they force initiates to divulge their sexual past, present, and future fantasies, and they like getting as much dirt as possible on these individuals in order to have leverage and to be able to play mind games and basically blackmail them in the future. But they do that with the likes of us all the time.
Yeah, I know all about it. A couple of years ago, my daughter, Sarah, she came into our bedroom in the early hours of the morning, and she was screaming and crying. She was absolutely distraught, and she had found a woman in our house that was at my computer. And so the next morning, and when she found her, she then she saw her, the woman smiled at her. And Sarah then sort of, you know, smiled back and went back into her bedroom and, you know, locked her door in fear. But she looked out of her window, you know, thinking of climbing out of the window and then coming around to my side of the house and you know, banging on my window. But when she looked out the window, there was a guy standing out there holding two bicycles. And she said that he had a tie on and he was just standing there. And so she closed the curtain again and waited for them to leave before she came down to my room. And, you know, I would assume the next day I saw the bicycle tracks. You know, this is the sort of thing that goes on. You know, I assume that they were from some intelligence agency. You know, people think that, you know, you put an alarm systems. I mean, I'm a specialist in this area. I've had, you know, covert camera systems and, you know, advanced, you know, like Centrax alarm systems and all the rest. And I can tell you that the people in the, you know, in the intelligence agencies, they bypass these systems very, very quickly. You know, you've got an alarm box in your house. I don't know if many people know, but there are key alarm codes that bypass that system. You know, people in the security industry know that. You might think that you've got the latest model, such and such, but there are, and you've got your own keypad number entered into it. That keypad number is only specific to you. There are other numbers that will deactivate that system.
And, yeah, it's like a master key sort of thing. Yeah.
Exactly. And, you know, this is the sort of antics that go on. You know, I had a camera system hooked up on my office. You know, it was a covert camera system. And the system, the tapes, the whole lot all disappeared. I used to have files. I had what I called the, I called it Chris's file. And it had, you know, all the key evidence against Far Financial and the defendants. And it kept on disappearing. The entire file kept on disappearing from my office. And that's why I put the camera system in. And, but of course, the camera system, you know, including the recording system, just disappeared.
Yeah, I mean, it really is James Bond stuff, and people don't believe it. And obviously it won't happen to the average person because they're just keeping out of the way and being a victim, pretty much, being abused daily. We call it life. But, yeah, I mean, these guys, they walk around with electromagnetic wands and just wipe your hard drives and mess your screens up and everything. I mean, yeah, they've got all sorts of gadgets. Even the, you know, if you can have spy cam watches with 8 gigabytes like I've got, you know, as a member of the public, I mean, imagine the sort of technology that's available to Secret Service members.
Oh, the technology is absolutely staggering. It's well beyond what anybody could even imagine. And, you know, but I've never had a problem about that. You know, I remember the film 1984, George Orwell's 1984, and, you know, how everybody's got cameras in their houses and states looking at you and following Big Brother's instructions. You know, I've often thought to myself that if everybody had cameras and microphones hidden in their house, the person they would be sitting there, you know, monitoring them all would come to realize that, you know, humans are humans and, you know, we're all pretty much so in the same boat. But, you know, as individuals, we can fail. But the people that we can't afford to fail are those that we trust to run our systems of state. Those people have to be, you know, I'm not saying that they, you know, can't smoke a joint and give it to the secretary over the desk or in the speaker's chair. That doesn't really worry me.
They'd probably, you know, just do just as terrible a job if you did, but go ahead.
Yeah, probably. Oh, I can tell you, I've been around some powerful people, mate. They smoke some good stuff. But the main focus has to be their duty of care, how well they look after the country. And, of course, in New Zealand, which is our subject, they're doing an absolutely appalling job. And we New Zealanders have to do something about it. We have to modernise. our systems of democracy, and I'd like to see us do it in New Zealand, so that we can use it as a test ground for other countries around the world. If we can get it right in New Zealand, I think that there could be no better gift to humanity than to offer people a proper, accountable, transparent government system.
Well, has that ever occurred before, I wonder?
Well, the government want a transparent public, and that's the problem. It's all reversed, isn't it? It's all the other
way
around.
Transparent rooftops, and in the case of airport body scanners, transparent clothing, so that they can feel your naughty bits. You're listening to The Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and TheVinnieEastwoodShow.com. Our very special guest joining us live from Perth in Western Australia is Chris Wingate, our Kiwi collaborator for today. We'll be right back. This goes out to the rich and the powerful.
I wanna jam it with you.
Toking up on the illegal substances that they do. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and TheVinnieEastwoodShow.com, proudly brought to you in collaboration with GorillaMedia.co.nz. Our very special Kiwi collaborator today is Chris Wingate, coming at us live from Perth, Western Australia. Chris, welcome back.
Welcome. Nice to be here.
Yeah, it is. It's been pretty freaking fabulous having you on, mate. Now, intelligence agencies themselves, I mean, how much influence would you say they actually have on, say, the New Zealand Parliament, like SIS? And one thing that comes to mind for me was how the SIS basically keeps files on all the parliamentarians and actually keeps tabs on them. Particularly in recent times, our MP Keith Locke from the Green Party and Nando Tanchos from the Green Party as well, they were actively surveilled by the state intelligence services. So, you know, it's pretty freaky, you know. If they're supposed to have parliamentary and judicial immunity, why do the intelligence agencies need to keep tabs on them? You know, I mean, in my opinion, it looks like nobody's got tabs on them, but they do.
Well, the, you know, that raises a very good question. Who exactly do our intelligence agencies owe loyalty to? And, you know, you get the likes of Green MPs, of course. You know, these are people who, you know, their agenda is protection of the environment, you know, the stopping of destruction of the environment. And, of course, that's totally contrary to, you know, to a number of major oil interests around the world.
You speak
up
to
all sorts. Yeah, a number of oil industries around the world would hate the idea of the Greens, you know, really gaining any traction. So, you know, if the three of us were running, you know, between us, you know, various oil companies, we would obviously be looking at protecting our interests in the best way possible. And there's nothing better than, you know, using every asset at our disposal to ensure that we know exactly what the enemy is up to. And, you know, that's what intelligence agencies do. There are a lot of, you know, private organisations around the world that have ex-specialist members of intelligence agencies. I remember in New Zealand, of course, you've got GCSB, which is the electronic arm of the Secret Intelligence Service, and a lot of those people are military personnel. These are people that, you know, they don't question orders; they're simply given an instruction to you know, carry out an action, and they do it without you know, without wondering why. But what I found over the years is that there are a number of people in amongst a variety of different security services people are starting to question what exactly is going on. I mean, these people have access to the internet, to the newspapers. They can see that there's always two sides to a story. They see the media displaying one angle, and they get to see the other angle. They get to see it firsthand, and they realise that you know, there's a lot of propaganda going on in the world. I remember as a young kid growing up, the Vietnam War, you know, the Viet Cong were the arch enemy. These people were shocking. Well, the Fog of War documentary with McNamara, I thought the most interesting point that was made in that documentary was McNamara's comment that, you know, we thought that they were trying to spread communism when, in fact, all they were trying to do was get rid of the invaders who were invading their country. And, you know, this is the problem with a lot of people in government, is that they can be manipulated with other agendas. And in that particular case, I would suggest that the agenda was the sale of arms, you know, the American Treasury paying for hundreds of billions of dollars of manufactured weapons, and that the weapons industries were directly influencing political decision to go to war in Vietnam. Iraq was exactly the same. You know, I would suggest that Afghanistan is exactly the same. And as I said earlier on, my fear is that they're going to piss the wrong person off, and you know, innocent people will pay the price. They don't.
Well, Chris, I mean, you brought up the point about our intelligence agencies. I mean, some of the spooks involved, you know, they're not stupid people, obviously, and I'd like to think, you know, they're monitoring a lot of my activity, obviously. So, and Vinny's and yourselves, and you know, a lot of probably about 100 people I know that would be under surveillance. I'd like to think that they're seeing the sort of information we're dispersing and seeing that we're on, you know, we're on a true cause. We're on the side of people in general. We're not terrorists. We're not, you know, we're not wanting to destroy this country in any way. Rather, quite the opposite. And I'd like to think that they'd be with us in some sort of moral level and kind of leave us alone, let us be. And that has been the case so far. But I do wonder why the hell they're doing their job sometimes. I wonder why, when they're smart enough to understand what's going on, they continue to work for these scum. And you know, it's not really worth the 80 grand, the 120 grand, or whatever little perks they have. You know, you guys need to get out of there and join us.
Wishful thinking, perhaps. I'd like to thank you very much, Chris, for coming on the show with us today, mate. It's been an absolute honour and a pleasure.
Well, it's been great to be on. You know, it's funny, I got a phone call from a friend of mine in New Zealand last night, coincidentally, who he's ex-government intelligence. It just seemed rather coincidental that he was phoning me up to just try and find out, you know, what have I been up to?
Well, I hope you listened in today, and regardless of what your cause, remember that a lack of immunity is what we really need at the highest levels. We need total transparency, regardless of what your cause, even if you're a climate changer. How about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Let's take away their immunity so that they could be struck down by the disease of freedom. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Thank you very much for tuning in, ladies and gentlemen. The archives of this show will be available at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. Our special guest has been Chris Wingate, coming to us live from Perth, Australia, on the Kiwi Collaborator section. And we'll be back tomorrow.